We're talking with the head of the Oneida Nation on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The chairman of the Oneida Nation, Dehasi Hill, delivered the 15th annual State of the Tribes address to the Wisconsin legislature yesterday. We're looking at key points of his speech, gathering your reaction along the way at 800-642-1234. Are you a member of one of the tribes Chairman Hill was representing yesterday? What's an aspect of his speech that really hit home for you? Was it his call to address the opioid epidemic? Was it access to health care, his emphasis on environmental protections? Join in by phone. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chairman Dehasi Hill was born and raised on the Oneida Reservation. He is from the Bear Clan, and he graduated from the Oneida Nation High School. He was elected chairman of the Oneida Business Committee in 2017. Chairman Hill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, each year, the Great Lakes Intertribal Council selects a member of a tribe to give the State of the Tribes address to the legislature. Why were you selected to give the address this year?
We try to do it on a rotating basis, and I guess Oneida hasn't been up to deliver the State of the Tribes address since the first or the second time it was completed. So it was.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
You were there representing Wisconsin's Native tribes, and what did you want to hit home to lawmakers and convey about these tribes through this address to the legislature?
Well, I think it was very important to make sure that everybody was aware of the tribes' current standings within the state and our economies and our culture and the environment. And our families were our top priorities for tribes generally across the state.
How are families doing among the tribes?
Well, according to census data, tribes are doing much better than they have been since between the 1990 census to the most recent census. There has been quite significant improvements tribes have been making for general family income, and the poverty rates have all been improving, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Poverty and unemployment still an issue.
Yes, definitely.
Last May, the Oneida Nation partnered with St. Norbert College to measure its economic impact on the economy. What did you find?
Yes, that was a very interesting study. We've been looking forward for that information for having that study completed for quite some time. And it really showed how much Oneida has grown over the years, about a $300 million increase in economic impact since 2006 to last year, which is, I think, a tremendous increase that we were able to provide more jobs for families, living wages, and really improve our health care on the reservation for our community members and our employees. So there was great strides in education made as well. And we were able to demonstrate the cost savings, I guess, to the state and local governments when the tribe takes over programs and services for our members. It saves the state of Wisconsin tax dollars.
When you look at the impact on the economy and the state's overall economy, and you're saying that household incomes are rising, fewer families are in poverty, what about median household income? How has that changed? What do the numbers look like?
Well, one of the important, I guess, aspects since 1990 to current, the household median income has continued to grow. And incomes for families living on the reservations is still falls behind the state of Wisconsin general public. The tribal families are only earning about 70% median income as compared to the state residents. So there's still growth, but there's still a lot of room for improvement, and we hope continuing to work with the state of Wisconsin and our local governments to assure that the economic impacts of the nation also helps raise up the families in our communities as well.
We're talking with Dehasi Hill. He's chairman of the Oneida Nation, and he delivered the 15th annual State of the Tribes address to the Wisconsin legislature yesterday. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see the state legislature address the points Chairman Hill raised? What obstacles do you see in the way of that happening? What opportunities do you see? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chairman Hill, let's talk about Act 31 that you brought up in your speech. You highlighted this proposal that the State Tribal Relations Committee recommended and the Joint Legislative Council voted to introduce as legislation, Act 31. Can you tell us about what that does?
Yes, that's the state statute that mandates that Native American history and cultures and sovereignty be taught in public school systems. And so that has a far-reaching effect on both our families and our communities when people know the history of the state and its, I guess, its first inhabitants, being Native Americans, and the contributions that we have made both to the state and to this country are very important.
How is Act 31 doing? Is it making a difference, do you see?
Yeah, I think it definitely is making a difference. You know, this act was put in place back in the 80s and early 90s when tribal sovereignty was under attack and treaty rights, specifically the fishing rights, were under scrutiny, especially in northern Wisconsin. And part of what came out of that was the need for better education of all the state residents about Native American tribes in Wisconsin and our treaty rights that have been upheld over the years, and specifically the what are some of the more important ones for individual tribal members is both the rights to hunt, fish, and gather.
Your speech also pointed out that there are still dozens of public schools using mascots, logos, or nicknames. And I remember when my own high school mascot was changed in 1989. How do you hope to see the legislature address this?
Yeah, I definitely would hope that new legislation is put into place. There has been several states, and I think more recently it might have been Massachusetts had just passed a state law kind of banning the use of Indian mascots and logos in public schools. So I think that's really the direction that we're looking to move the state of Wisconsin forward.
You also brought up the environment. We often hear about the ways global warming is affecting us quite broadly, but how might global warming impact the tribes in particular?
Well, I guess in particular for us, you know, as a part of climate change also comes with invasive species of, you know, bugs and insects that weren't native to this area coming in and harming some of our cultural resources. Like for Oneida specifically, we use the black ash tree to make our traditional baskets, and the emerald ash borer is devastating that tree across the entire state of Wisconsin. So things like that are very detrimental. And then also with climate change, even for the Chippewa tribes, the birch bark tree is very significant to them for their baskets and canoes and artwork. So, you know, as the forests warm, trees that are more do better in the environment when it's with cooler temperatures, they will recede and move further north and potentially out of the state of Wisconsin eventually.
We're talking with Oneida Nation Chairman Tehasi Hill a day after his State of the Tribes address to the Wisconsin legislature, looking at key takeaways from his speech, getting your insights as well at 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking with the head of the Oneida Nation on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Native Americans in Wisconsin continue to trail behind the general public in many critical areas. Chairman Tayasi Hill pointed out these statistics in his address. The unemployment rate is double when compared to the rest of Wisconsin residents. Poverty rate almost three times all of Wisconsin families. Substance abuse rates 6 to 8 times higher than the general population. Did you watch Oneida Nation Chairman Tayasi Hill's speech yesterday? What aspects of his speech struck you the most? Are you a member of the tribes Chairman Hill was representing yesterday? What do you want to ask the leader of the Oneida Nation? Join in at 800-642-1234 as Chairman Hill stays with us. Let's now talk about health care. In your speech, you pointed out that the Indian health system, a federal program, is really underfunded. Give us some more context to that. What does the funding look like?
Well, I guess in general, the for the Midwest region, tribes receive it's really only about 40% of the need, 44% of the need. So what that means is tribes are footing the bill to make sure that adequate health care is provided. And so, you know, as you know, I mentioned in the speech, the federal government through its treaties has guaranteed that the health and welfare of American Indians be taken care of, because the large cessions of land and resources treated to the United States from tribes across the country really is kind of the impetus of why we still have this treaty rights in place, and the guarantees of the health care for our members is vitally important that we maintain these contracts.
Let's look at the opioid epidemic. It has had a considerable impact on tribes. Can you give us a snapshot of what that looks like compared to the rest of Wisconsin?
Yes, the opioid epidemic has really hit tribes, you know, across the country quite hard. And you know, one of the aspects that we really looking hard at is the reasons why people are trying to self-medicate, essentially. You know, what's going on in their lives that would cause them to want to try these illegal drugs. And the more we look into it, it's really about the historical trauma that our people have faced over the generations. And so that is really a large cause. And not everybody is educated about the historical traumas that our ancestors have went through, and maybe even not even as far back as, you know, hundreds of years ago. Just we're talking, you know, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s about federal government policies that were detrimental to tribes across this country.
Let's go to Mark now, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, Chairman Hill, thank you for your address yesterday. I look forward to hearing that. I actually live right on the edge of the Oneida Nation reservation, and I'm not a tribal member. I'm newer to the community. And so my question is kind of twofold. More specifically for me, being in our community, are there any specific ways that you can think of that I can help partner with your community, that our communities can work even closer together? And then perhaps in a more broader sense, as you spoke on behalf of the many nations within Wisconsin, what about some of the folks like me who aren't a part of any particular tribe but are looking for ways to connect with our overall community and, kind of partner with what you guys are doing?
Great questions, Mark.
Yes, thank you for that question. That was, I think there's a lot of opportunities, especially, you know, locally. I think it's important that we have friendly people and elected to local government positions. I think that goes a long way in helping tribes. People who are, you know, open-minded and want to work together, you know, really would help the local relationships between the local governments and the tribes in the state. So I think that's one very large, I think, aspect, important aspect going forward is participation in the government at whatever level is possible. And then and the other, to answer your other question, there's, you know, here in Oneida, we put on a lot of public events, and we do a lot of community outreach, and And I think it's really just getting familiar, coming to our events and getting to know the people, getting to know your neighbors. I think that's that also goes a long ways in building and trust and community support for each other's endeavors. You know, as I mentioned this in the speech, a lot of the things that are affecting tribes are also affecting Wisconsin residents in general. So any time that we can get together and talk about issues and try to find solutions, whether it be at a festival or just sitting down in a restaurant having a lunch together, all those things are, I think, great steps that move Wisconsin forward.
Chairman Hill, as we wrap up, there were a number of issues you addressed yesterday in your speech. What do you focus on with the legislature to impact change in all of the areas you've addressed?
Well, really, I think it's continued work and collaboration on the State Tribal Relations Committee. That is the committee where all the tribes have representation on the committee, and they work with the state legislature to identify areas that are of mutual interest that we hopefully can get bipartisan support on to move these issues forward. And I really think that's a great model for other states to follow and for Wisconsin to continue to support.
Well, Chairman Hill, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Kate.
Deasy Hill is chairman of the United Nation, and he joined us the morning after delivering the 15th annual State of the Tribes address to the Wisconsin legislature. We're talking now about LGBTQ elected officials on the morning show. More openly lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are winning elections, signaling a shift in cultural attitudes. As of this year, all 50 states have been served by openly LGBTQ elected politicians in some capacity. Are you a newly elected lawmaker who identifies within the LGBTQ community? Why did you run for office? What is it like to be in your political role? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Stephanie Barron. She is a doctoral student and lecturer of LGBT studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it seems like, and there is some documentation here, that more LGBTQ candidates are running for office. Why now? Why this moment?
Well, I think we've always had LGBTQ populations running for office. They may not have necessarily felt comfortable enough to be out. So I do feel, though, that this current visibility is nothing but positive for marginalized communities across the board to feel more comfortable to run for office and to have folks to look up to who have run through the same process and can go through, challenges, strengths, et cetera, in order to win office.
Why do you think voters are electing these candidates? And how important is your sexual identity?
I mean, I feel like sometimes cisgender straight folks only view LGBTQ candidates in terms of their sexual identity or their out sexual identity. But really, just like every other person, LGBTQ populations are also multidimensional and diverse individuals themselves with policies, initiatives, and things that they'd like to incorporate that they feel perhaps are missing from the current political climate. So I think that many people are looking at the policies that LGBTQ candidates are putting forth, and then also they just also happen to be LGBT, queer, et cetera.
Do you think there is a progressive wave right now, or what some are calling this rainbow wave happening?
You know, I'm a little bit resistant to do like a progressive wave or a rainbow wave, because just because someone is LGBTQ, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're overwhelmingly going to be super progressive. They may have issues with mass incarceration or policies that disproportionately are affecting Black and brown communities or trans communities or homeless populations. So it really boils down to keeping folks accountable for their actions, decisions, policies, and I think that's the important part. So I'm a little resistant to say progressive wave or rainbow wave. I am excited though to see the representation, and I feel like a diverse and multi-voiced, you know, state, local, or national legislature is nothing but positive.
LGBT candidates ran for office in record numbers last year. We're talking about how the political landscape is becoming more diverse, what voters think about in this cultural shift. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Coming up after a news update, we'll be talking with the new mayor of Madison, who is the first openly gay and the second woman executive in the city's history. Stay with us for that conversation and more on LGBT candidates right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about LGBTQ elected officials on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A wave of openly gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people are being elected to all levels of government. So rewind a bit when in 2012, when Tammy Baldwin made history becoming the first openly gay person to take a seat in the U.S. Senate, but rewind back to 1998 when she became the first woman elected to the House of Representatives. There are now 8 LGBTQ members of the House, 2 in the Senate, and the count of LGBTQ mayors across the country, it stands at 37, with Madison joining the ranks. Are you a newly elected lawmaker who identifies within the LGBTQ community? Why did you run for office? What's it like to be in your political role? Do you identify with the LGBTQ community? What do you think of the so-called rainbow wave? We're at 800-642-1234. Stephanie Barron is a lecturer of LGBT studies at UW-Milwaukee, and Stephanie stays with us. It seems like, Stephanie, more LGBTQ candidates right now who are running for office, does that mean that we're going to see more of these types of perhaps policy with these candidates? Does LGBTQ candidates mean LGBTQ policy?
Well, yes and no. I think that there's a, like I said, just because someone is a marginalized identity or identifies somewhere along the lines of LGBTQ, I feel like those issues are part of them as human people. But also there's other ways in which you might experience a level of also wanting to do other things as well. And so I think the LGBTQ policy is part of that identity, but I don't think it's all of the identity. There's still issues how mayors or local officials might want to tackle issues of hunger or homelessness and policing and incarceration. And I think you have to consider LGBTQ populations in that as well as other marginalized identities as well.
The Trump administration isn't as LGBTQ policy friendly as the Obama administration was. Has this motivated candidates and activists? Is there any correlation there?
Well, I feel like the nation at this moment is at this really weird spot. We have when I was an undergrad at Loyola, I had a professor who is now Representative Mike Quigley, and he said that all politics is local. So all of the what we're seeing perhaps in our local governments or city governments or state governments, et cetera, is really the thing that is showing movement and change. And I think more nationally, we're looking at it's sort of a way in which perhaps the two need to eventually, I feel like it's going to bubble up. And instead of trickle down because of the movements that we're seeing at the more local level. And the more local level is really the day-to-day that affects us more often than some of these more national or federal policies. And then even with Obama, he also, at the beginning of his presidency, struggled with accessing and understanding and facilitating that LGBTQ conversation. But he showed over time that you could, you know, once you listened and learned, you could access those populations and understand those viewpoints a little bit better than I think the current president might be willing to do.
Well, let's bring in the newly elected mayor of Madison to the conversation. We have Satya Rhodes Conway, and she is the first openly LGBT person to serve as mayor of Madison after defeating Paul Soglin. Satya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So when you first thought about running for mayor, why was it important for you to let the community know you're a gay woman?
Well, first of all, I identify as lesbian or queer, and it was not even a question. I've been out since high school, and I was out when I ran for city council and won. You know, I was out when I got the job at UW that I've had for the past 13 years, and there was just no question of, you know, going back into the closet, as it were. So it's just who I am. I ran as a woman. I ran as a lesbian. I ran as, you know, somebody who.
And you felt like there wasn't any.
Degree. I mean, you know, yeah, there's yeah. No question there.
Right. And not that you really didn't feel like you had to do much explaining for your voters about your identity. You could focus on policy.
Yes.
So
that
you.
It was not. I mean, you know, I think it's important because who I am. My identity informs my approach to the world and how I look at issues, but it was more important for me to connect with the people of Madison around the issues and challenges that Madison is facing.
And you were elected just over a week ago. You'll be sworn into office next week. How are you feeling right now?
I'm pretty excited. The transition team, the team period is very short, but we're working hard, and it's really exciting.
Do you see that you are contributing to a bigger moment, perhaps, in history here?
Absolutely. You know, I do think, despite it being really easy for me to run as an out candidate, I know that that's not true for folks everywhere, and that there are folks who do have to make more of a decision when they're deciding to run as an out LGBTQ person. And I think it's really important that we make those decisions. I have had many people come up to me in the course of the campaign and since the election who have said either for themselves how important it is for them that I was running as an out lesbian or how important it is for their kids to have a role model of an out LGBTQ person in a leadership position. Mm. And that's why I think it's so important. You know, it's, I mean, for me, it was just, I mean, this is just who I am, right? But I think it's important for the community and particularly for young LGBTQ people to see us in leadership positions and know that they can be in leadership positions as well.
One other thing I want to ask you about that when you won the election, you also quoted Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official in California who was assassinated in 1978. Why did you look to his words?
You know, Harvey has always been an inspiration to me, and I think to many LGBTQ folks, whether we run for office or not. Again, because of that ability to see yourself in a leader and in an elected official, in the same way that Tammy Baldwin has been an inspiration to me and Mark Buchan has been an inspiration to me. When I sat down to, you know, you write two speeches, right? and when I sat down to write those, I was looking for a quote to sort of center them around and sort of thinking through, all right, well, who do I want to invoke in this moment? And I thought, well, gosh, who better than Harvey Milk?
Mm. Satya, thank you so much for sharing with us and your time.
Of course, it's a pleasure.
That was Madison's mayor. She was elected April 2nd in the election, Satya Rhodes Conway. Stephanie Barron, back to you. When you hear Satya looking for inspiration and saying, you know what, I've been out for a long time. I just didn't see it as an issue. What do you hear there?
It's important. I really think that if we had adequate LGBTQ curriculum in schools, we could learn that LGBTQ history didn't just start with Stonewall. It didn't just start with Jean Compton's. LGBTQ history is U.S. history. It's American history. It's human history. It's world history. And I think if we had a better understanding of that historical timeline, we might be better able to know that, LGBTQ populations are present and have been present, but also have existed through years and, many issues of oppression and decades of oppression, perhaps centuries of oppression. I think hearing Satya, it's important because she had these folks to look up to, but I know that there are so many more, and Satya could be is an inspiration for future politicians coming down the road, or future public speakers, or future educators, just to know that there's somebody who they identify with in the same way that she identified with Milk and other politicians as well.
And these, openly lesbian women elected as mayor, Satya Rhodes Conway in Madison, Jolie Justice in Kansas City, Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, there's visibility there. How does this visibility help people's lives?
Well, I think there's hopefully a level of advocacy in the sense that in many times when we think about like cisgender straight politicians, we often, for some reason, think about them being able to advocate for everybody when really many bodies are regulated, women's, trans women, bodies of color, indigenous bodies. And so for some reason, we think that only LGBT folks are only considering managing this particular thing of LGBTness when really all of them are interconnected. And so I hopefully want us to start breaking away from this idea that it's just LGBT issues and not all of the things that are connected to the LGBTQ issue experience, right? Like housing, education, access to healthcare, adequate healthcare, jobs, income, wealth, et cetera.
The list goes on.
Yeah.
We're looking at the recent progress made by gay and lesbian politicians getting elected to offices at all levels of government. What this moment says, if anything, about sexual orientation in politics. Stephanie Barron is our guide. She is a UW-Milwaukee lecturer of LGBT studies. You can bring in your thoughts to the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you teach LGBTQ studies or politics? How are you addressing this topic in your classroom? Have you experienced defensive feelings from students or parents? You can call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up this conversation in just a minute right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the wave of LGBTQ candidates winning elected office and what this moment means. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to a recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll, nearly 70% of Americans said they would be either enthusiastic about or comfortable with a presidential candidate who is gay or lesbian. We're looking at cultural shifts and what it means for sexual orientation in politics. Getting your thoughts along the way, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Are you a business or organization that promotes LGBTQ rights? Have you encouraged LGBTQ candidates to run for office? Do you identify with the LGBTQ community? How are you feeling at this moment? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie Barron is our guide. She is a lecturer of LGBT studies at UW-Milwaukee. Stephanie, when you look at the numbers, do these candidates, these newly elected people in offices, do they tend to skew to align with one party over another?
Well, I don't want to discount that there are LGBTQ members of that might identify as Republican, but I feel that perhaps it might come down to issues that are outside identity, and one party is more hard on that. For example, tough on crime often gets people, but sometimes tough on crime means tougher and disparate and disproportionate effects on communities of color and poor communities. And I also feel that track record wise, the Democratic Party might have access to or have had policies that have been more favorable to LGBTQ communities and marginalized communities, in the sense that they're not so punitive or vindictive in that sense. So I feel that in some cases, yes, there is this identity that goes along with political affiliation. When I was a master's student at DePaul, I did a study on racial and gender beliefs in terms of political affiliation. And it can be a two-way street. The literature tells us that it could be identity formation informs political affiliation, or sometimes it's political affiliation informs identity. And so it really depends on that individual person to where in which what party they align with and what that party is talking about. I mean, perhaps – I mean – even within the LGBTQ community, historically, not every LGBTQ person is on the same page with every other LGBTQ person. So you could have someone who has interesting views about immigrants or problematic views about folks of color. And so I think that the intricate ways in which we can form these identities is also important to take into account when considering sexual identity. Sorry.
Let's bring in Karen now from Green Bay. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because we have a son who's gay and a nephew, and I have friends who are transgender and gay and bi. And I'm just really disappointed with this whole Hagedorn election, and also I can't remember what the name of the other Supreme Court justice is, who
Lisa
also
Neubauer?
Very badly.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Okay.
The other Supreme Court candidate who had written negatively about gays in the past. And I can't, her name, I just can't remember her name right now. Anyway, I just wondered about this Hagedorn thing and about that other justice who was elected. And I had a lot of hope that things were changing, but when things like this happen, it makes me feel sad and angry. And I'm wondering what we can do so these people don't get onto aren't elected. You know, I do all I can, and I still feel really sad about that.
Karen, thank you for the call. So it sounds like when the politics really hit home for Karen's family, that has an impact on her and how she sees her son.
Mm-hmm. I think we also have to look geographically at where we find these wins occurring. And, you know, Madison, Eau Claire, and in some cases Chicago, the Lightfoot election, she won in very proportionately white districts, and much of that is due to her tough on crime aspects. So there's some we could unpack that a little bit later.
Yeah.
But I feel like state wise, Wisconsin is a weird state, and I'm talking about this as someone who doesn't. I'm not from here. I'm from Chicago, and so in these more highly clustered population sects, we see a little bit more Democratic candidates being elected. So here in Milwaukee and Madison and Eau Claire, and these are also college towns as well. And typically poll show and statistics and surveys show that if there's a college in that town, hypothetically, it might lean a certain way to the more left, center left, et cetera.
Well, Stephanie, I want to pause here and bring in Laura Benjamin, who is one of the three newly elected Eau Claire City Council members. She is the first transgender woman elected to office in Wisconsin. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
How do you think your experience translates to other members of the LGBTQ community in Wisconsin and as you hold elected office?
Well, I have to say, I echo a lot of what your guest has said. I ran on issues related more to our local economy and the growth that we're trying to see here with jobs and wages, more so than the fact that I am transgender. And it didn't come out until later in the campaign that it was even an issue for some people in our local region.
Why did you decide to run for office as an openly transgender woman?
Well, a number of things. I have transitioned publicly. I am a business owner here in Eau Claire, and it was a very visible transition. And so it wasn't like a choice. I wasn't like, well, I'm going to decide whether to be open or closeted. I knew that was going to be part of the conversation, and it was something that we talked about early on. But what really inspired me to run was both some of the local issues around our economy and also things like the current administration's attacks on Title VII and how they want to redefine at a federal level what it means to be discriminating on the basis of sex and only biological sex being the protected class in the Title VII discrimination.
Do you see us in a new place for equity right now? We've heard lots of talk about this rainbow wave. Are we in a new moment or not?
I like to think so. I feel like, you know, despite what happened with Brian Hagedorn's election and some of the people that came out in support of his more conservative views with regards to that, I feel like I got a lot of support from people who said, you know, your LGBTQ status doesn't matter to me. What matters to me are your policies and the ways in which that you want to lead our community. And so I feel there is a bit of a change in that it's whether it's weighed in as a factor or not, it doesn't necessarily matter as much unless it's in a more positive way.
Well, Laura, thank you for taking a moment with us. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Laura Benjamin is one of three newly elected Eau Claire City Council members and the first transgender woman elected to office in Wisconsin. Stephanie, as we start to close this conversation, what do you think the future holds? What does it look like for LGBTQ involvement in politics?
Well, there's no negative to more voices in the room, more seats at the table. I think even with Hagedorn's, to the person who called in earlier about that, it's sad, yes, but we also have to look at we have to focus on our wins, right? Those are the ways in which we're going to make positive change. And just by being a positive force in all her family's lives and struggles and issues, I think that's what matters over his particular election. In the state of Wisconsin. And I think also it shows that Wisconsin itself is going through a bit of, change and flux, and all politics is local. We can see that change happening here. But I feel like there's no negative to more voices in the room. And with all of the folks that are coming out as LGBTQ candidates who are running really progressive candidacies and whatnot, I think that it's nothing but positivity, and I'm hopeful that we see some change go further in our nation and how we access these programs or people and issues and et cetera.
Stephanie, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
Stephanie Barron is a lecturer of LGBT studies at UW-Milwaukee. Just ahead, we're trying to understand the concept of hope. We'll talk with a social psychologist as we learn about hope, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.